That's Kate Boo at the Clinton screening of Romeo is Bleeding on Thursday, November 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
Welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Eileen Miles, is the author of more than 20 books of poetry, fiction, nonfiction, librettos, and plays. As a poet, they came into being through the St. Mark's Poetry Project in New York City in the 1970s, studying under the likes of Alice Notley and Ted Berrigan, and ultimately becoming the artistic director at St. Mark's in the mid-1980s. In the late 70s, they published the poetry magazine Dodgems that is described as a collision of New York school language poetry, performance texts, unconventional prose, and tossed-off notes from neighbors and celebrities. In the same era, Miles also co-edited the feminist anthology Ladies' Museum and worked as an assistant for the poet James Schuyler. The early 1990s saw a leap in Miles' visibility with the release of their poetry collection Not Me from Semiotext, their write-in candidacy for president, and the release of the novel Chelsea Girls. It was also in the 90s when Miles toured Germany with Kathy Acker, Lynn Tillman, Richard Hell, and Chris Kraus, and co-edited the anthology The New FU Adventures in Lesbian Reading. Since 2000, in addition to the poetry collections Miles released, Miles published the novels Cool for You and Inferno, a Poet's Novel, wrote the libretto for the opera Hell, released the essay collection The Importance of Being Iceland, Travel Essays in Art, and created and directed the performance piece The Collection of Silence, which involved dancers, poets, children, visual artists, and Buddhists in a collective public act of silence at the Hispanic Society in New York. As a poet and art journalist, Miles has appeared in a wide range of publications, including Art Forum, The New Yorker, Harper's, The Nation, The New York Times, and The Paris Review. They are the winner of 4 Lambda Literary Awards, the Clark Prize for Excellence in Art Writing, and the Shelley Memorial Award from the Poetry Society of America. And most recently, Miles has had both a significant retrospective moment with the reissue of Chelsea Girls and the release of their new and selected poems, I Must Be Living Twice, both from Echo Press, and the introduction of their work to a new audience with their poetry featured in season 2 and 3 of the show Transparent, with a character on the show being modeled after Miles and with Miles also appearing on the show themselves. As if that were not enough, Miles is also the recent recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, which facilitated the writing of their most recent book that we're talking about today, Afterglow, a Dog Memoir. Writer Colm Tobin says of Afterglow, following Eileen Miles around a dog is like following Leopold Bloom around Dublin. Reading Afterglow is like entering the company of a sensibility that is rich, original, witty, and tonally brilliant. It is the darting asides, the phrasing, and the subplots that matter most in this book that give pure, sheer, constant pleasure. Chris Kraus adds, "What is a dog if not God?" In Afterglow, Eileen Miles steps up to the challenge for writers to function as prophets. Ghostwritten in part by deceased pit bull Rosie, this dog memoir explores, among other things, geometry, gender, mortality, evil, aging, and plaids. Miles makes new rules for what prose writing can be. Afterglow is Miles' funniest, profoundest work yet. Welcome to Between the Covers, Eileen Miles.
Hey, David.
Hey there. Well, if we look at your two novels that precede Afterglow, you called Cool for You a nonfiction novel, and Inferno is a poet's novel.
Mm-hmm.
And you've also talked about wanting to mess with the term novel.
Right.
And it feels like memoir comes with a lot that people bring to the word memoir, to an expectation of a memoir. And I was wondering, because I feel like Afterglow could be a nonfiction novel also, but you're calling it a dog memoir. So mm-hmm. tell us if you're also trying to trouble that term, and if so, in what way?
Right. Well, it's so funny. I mean, I think the term memoir is troubled, you know? I mean, I remember, like, I don't know if it was in the 90s or even the aughts, when when there became like a rush of memoirs. And I remember this kind of mainstream elders sort of sneering and saying these are like half lives. You know, like a memoir is supposed to be the grand old man or woman, but mostly guys who had lived an enormously long life and had incredible things to talk about of great significance to everyone. And it would be, you know, some younger woman having some story to tell about something that wasn't, you know, like a political supposedly concert, you know. And so, and I've always liked nonfiction, and it's sort of newer forms and its sort of raggediness. And I came up at a time when new journalism was like really hot stuff when I was in college, like Tom Wolfe and Joan Didion and Hunter Thompson, and it was like wild. And it just seemed like poetry and the day and politics were all merging in this way, and everybody was kind of jazzy, like people were just kind of improvising with where they would bust the boundaries. And but for me, it still always seemed like memoir had to do with some recitation of truth, you know, or it too often, you know, like Oprah's mad at, was it James Fry, because his memoir wasn't actually true. And so I felt like it always seemed more contractual than anything I ever wanted to do, you know. But when my dog started dying, I just started writing, because that's what I do. That's what I know how to do. And it just was this accumulation. And I thought it was simply a nonfiction book that was about her. So it almost like kind of titillated me that I thought, okay, this can be a memoir because it's about a dog and she really is dying and I really do want on. My desire was simple and sentimental. And so I thought I would go with it. But of course, the messing with the form came later when I, you know, like I basically shot my 50-page wad of what her dying was. And then it was the aftermath, which kept turning and turning into other things and multiplying and becoming metonymic and frothy and foamy. And so it just, you know, I think the thing with a book, period, is that it always becomes a writing workshop with oneself. And so after that first burst, you have to figure out how to keep going and how to construct that going. And so all of that wound up being like a memoir. I think, you know, the book was, for a long time, it was called My Dog. And it kept being referred to as the dog book by the time I, you know, and then I think accidentally I was in Provincetown and there was an after season arts festival called Afterglow. And I had the postcard up over my desk and I was like, wait a second, you know. And so when it became that, it still seemed like it kept being called the dog book. So it was very late that we decided to. But I think I knew it was a memoir. I mean,
yeah.
To answer your question, I knew it was that, and I loved how much I was deforming that.
Yeah, and you mentioned two things that I wanted to bring up. The one, in the larger sense, this sense of expectation around authenticity and sincerity that it comes with the memoir, but then the particular expectation around pet memoirs of sentimentality or this expectation of a certain type of book. And you've mentioned that you didn't want to write a sappy dog memoir, but you wanted to write an itchy dog memoir. So can you talk about what considerations go into writing an itchy dog memoir, one that, while maybe looking at sentiment, is also sort of undermining that expectation?
Well, I mean, I think it's the things you don't want to see. I mean, it's like to really focus not on what a wonderful dog she was, but more what it was like to see that creature corrode, you know, how icky and awful and exhilarating the dying of a loved one is. That it was this participatory. So I thought it, you know, like to let it be as dark as hell. I thought mm-hmm. it would be a punk account of a dog dying. And you know, I think that I think of a lot, and because I thought of it when I was writing it too, was all that when Frank O'Hara died, Larry Rivers got up at his memorial and told people what Frank looked like in the hospital before he died. Like he was swollen. He had tubes going in and out of him. It was just this kind of, and it always seemed like this amazing, you know, like action of an artist to say, here, look. I mean, like Baudelaire, you know, it's like our modern sense of beauty is an ugly thing, you know, which is that thing that why we, you know, in America, which is so crazy and conservative, we want, you know, a memorial, a war memorial. We don't want to see some ugly thing that looks like war. We want to see some, like, beautiful, right. You know. And I wanted, you know, I wanted to do the ugly thing, you know, which turned out to be a beautiful thing. And you know, and it just has lots of resonances, too, with AIDS. Because I just was with, I mean, those are my friends, Tim Dugos, you know, just people known and unknown who were close, very close to me, that I saw be covered in lesions, and gorgeous, mostly men who southern withered down into a bone and just swollen lips. And I mean, it was like we witnessed that. And yet I never did the whole thing with anybody. And I did the whole thing with Rosie. Mm-hmm. And that seemed really special.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Eileen Miles about her latest book, Afterglow, a Dog Memoir. There's a film that I thought of a lot when I was reading Afterglow that I wondered whether you'd seen. It was the Laurie Anderson's film, The Heart of a Dog, which is kind of a memoir essay, filmic essay about both her blind dog and the passing away of Lou Reed. Have you seen it?
I have. And I didn't see it for a while, and I was sort of curious. And anyway, yeah, I love that. I love that piece. It's kind of awesome. And I know her a little bit for a long time, and then we just were like, there was a festival in Denmark, and we were both there this summer, and so we like ate together and talked, and she's such a dog person.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. I mean, and she has a dog now that is a whole story unto itself, and she's kind of an amazing owner of...
One of the things that I think both that movie and this book share that I really admire is both books are contemplating death of specific people, but there's also a way in which they feel like they're touching upon a certain death happening on the national level. But it's not foregrounded. So in your case, we have the era of George Bush as president. Mm-hmm. And George Bush casts a shadow across Afterglow, mm-hmm. in a way, and makes periodic cameos in the book. And so you've made the idea of a dog mean many things. So you take on your dog's voice, your dad is your dog, the postman is a dog, God is a dog, and the dog is God. But the one of the early definitions of dog in the book is the interns for Bush, who are made to stay in the room while he farts over and over again and stinks them up. And I wondered if you could just talk a little bit about what's going on in the background of Afterglow and why Bush and a little bit of Condoleezza Rice appear, mm-hmm. and inform the story.
Right, right. Well, I think in a way, I mean, some of it's really mundane, because it's just as I was writing in my backyard at the beginning of the book, the trees that were in my backyard at the time come into the narrative. You know, the dog is dying and these are the trees. And then this is the weather, this is the news, and this is the political climate of this moment, you know. And one of the things I didn't know about living in California is that you're really shaped by the news in a way that you're not in New York City. You know, in New York City, I feel very shaped by the people I meet and the encounters and the real life. But somehow in Southern California, you would be in your car so much and you would just keep getting these bites. And so there was like a higher level of realism. And also I was lonely from my home. I was lonely from New York. And so I read the New York Times in this kind of incredible way, like it was like reality. But I think, you know, of course, George Bush's presidency was shocking in so many ways, because, I mean, Reagan was a fool. I think Harry Truman was a fool. I mean, you know, all of our presidents have been many different things, but there have been some very overtly foolish presidents, guys really not equipped for this job. And George Bush was so surely that. And so I think the, you know, the dog dynamic is, you know, kind of master-slave, you know, like subject and master. And there was a way when it became so reversed at that time. It's sort of like to have such an ill-equipped man be the master made us all be sort of doggy. Mm. And then to think that those who were even closer, you know, like the young aspiring people, the good, you know, the good kids, the kids who had done right, and what they get is to be submissive to. I mean, you look at the Trump White House right now and you're like, at what point does, you know, like, do you feel so humbled by the situation that you've got to get out? You know, like people say that everybody who's in the Trump White House is a little bit just kind of a little ruined by it, because you've acceded to such, you know, like, dysfunction, and your job is to prop it up. So I think that was just a more cartoony, and I think the relationship between this, you know, African-American rumored to be dyke conservative Condi was like fascinating and weird, that she was kind of his support system, and they would even play that she loved him. Remember, it was just like, she was like, they couldn't, yeah. Since she couldn't be a lesbian, she had to be in love. The lesbian is always purported to be in love with a certain guy. It's like a trope in TV shows and stuff. There's this like butchy woman, and she just is sad and pathetic and sort of in love with some guy she can't get because she's not pretty enough.
Is it true that you've said before that the term politically correct was a lesbian term that was then co-opted by the Bush administration?
Absolutely.
Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it's really funny. It's sort of like in the, you know, in the lesbian, you know, culture, extended culture of the 70s and 80s, but really the, I guess, probably the mid to late 70s, there were just these sort of characters in the culture who were like the people who were always asking that nobody in the room use perfume. You know, like it was sort of like they were very sensitive to smells, and it was just like, and we're certainly, you know, not meat eating, and not, you know, like, just there was such a list of things that were not okay in this room, and I'm very sensitive to these issues in our community, and I request that you talk this way, not that way. And it was so kind of like controlling, and, you know, like, I mean, you know, that those of us who were sort of more loudish and more kind of just messier characters laughed at them, but everybody called them politically correct. Huh. You know, it was those politically correct dykes. And it just meant that they really were always policing your speech and policing. So that's what was so strange, was to suddenly see that flipped into, I mean, some genius located that language and made it be all of us. Huh. Because it's, I mean, that's metonymy, right? Like, we suddenly all became the politically correct, those sort of pathetic, laughable people.
Since you said the word pathetic, I was also hoping maybe you could talk about pathetic and the pathetic. And
right.
You've talked before about pathetic literature and pathetic masculinities, and I think you're working on a pathetic anthology. What does that mean? Like, can you talk a little bit more about that word, and then that word in relationship to literature?
Right. Well, it's something that I think it was sort of inherited from the art world, because there was something in the 90s called pathetic masculinity, and it meant guys like Mike Kelly and I guess Tony Asler and sort of that ilk who were using crafts that were traditionally female and making abject work, you know, stuffed weird dirty bunnies and banners. Like, I think Mike Kelly was working class and went to a Catholic high, or I don't think he went to a Catholic high school, but I think grew up in Detroit maybe. And there was a certain kind of like Catholic modernism in the 60s that like weird banners and kind of like a scaly kind of thing, but it was all kind of, anyway, he just, you know, like, they imported all sorts of kind of strange arcane symbols and handmade things, and, you know, like the kind of woodwork that Dad did in the garage, and made that all be like high end art, you know. But the thing that was interesting was that it was also rumored that a lot of these guys had been educated by second wave feminists in art schools, and that, you know, so that they were very aware of like women having these big parties and using traditional female crafts to create kind of like strange, you know, lesbian funny love cushions and just kind of punky and political things and stuff. And so it was kind of importing that kind of feminism, undermining the feminine to make political statements, and then undermining that as Mike Kelly and all those guys, and creating this kind of pathetic masculinity. And then it became guys being personal, guys talking about their personal life, writing words on the wall, and doing all this stuff that really had been associated with the, you know, like if you look at Mary Kelly, this kind of, you know, like art of Eleanor Anton, you know, was kind of like art of the conceptual art of the third wave, of the second wave art world. And so I took that to literature and started to think about writers I knew who I loved, including myself, I thought, like, what does pathetic mean? And I started to see it used not as political correctness, but like, say, on the right, like, it was, what was her name? Cindy something, who had a son who was killed. Sheehan.
Yes, Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan.
Her son was killed, and so she parked herself at the end of George Bush's street in Texas. I can't remember the name of the town, and just wouldn't go away and started a protest there. And I remember on right-wing radio, and there was, and that pathetic woman, you know?
Yeah.
And what pathetic meant was a woman who wouldn't shut up. It was a woman who was, instead of being meek and mild and knowing her place, she did not know her place, and she was complaining to the President of the United States, and she was getting a lot of other people to complain, and she was taking up a lot of space. And by the same token, I can think of a guy, whether he was straight or gay, maybe he's a little chubby, but in any case, he probably talks a little too much and is a little too sensitive and a little too needy and a little bit not fulfilling the correct profile of masculinity, you know? And so I started to have this idea that pathetic in America meant kind of not kind of being obedient to your gender roles. And it was, you know, like, and just being excessive and kind of spilling over the boundaries. And it seemed like another way, like genre to kind of like police infusions of feeling that we don't want to hear about. And I thought, well, wait a second, think about the writers that I love. And I thought about my work. I thought about Chris Krause in I Love Dick. I thought about the poet John Wieners. I thought about aspects of Samuel Delaney, parts of Kathy Acker. Everybody is kind of molten and out of place and deformed and extra. And I thought, so this is not straight or gay. This is not avant-garde or mainstream. It's kind of a lush deformity. You know, and so I taught a class on that when I was teaching at UCSD. I had a seminar called Pathetic Literature, and I taught Kevin Killian. I taught Robert Walser, older writers who were part of this. A Chinese writer, San Shui, C-A-N-X-U-E. Mm-hmm. And now there's a woman who killed us, a Taiwanese writer, Chu Maojin, who published a book with New York Review of Books called, I think it was Last Days in Montmartre, and she wrote this kind of very, I Love Dick, kind of pre-internet, weird, like novel of letters that she said right at the beginning that she was going to kill herself at the end of the book, and she did.
Wow.
And she's an amazing writer, and she's one of us. She's part of our, you know, so it's, so I taught this class, and then we even had the Pathetic Conference, which was really fun. And Chris came, and we showed Valerie Solanas's I Am Man. And we had, I'm trying to think who else, you know, there were just readings and people showed films and, you know, and it was just kind of like rich and off and weird. And so I guess in there, because there's a chapter in this book about foam, which is something I began to be obsessed with when I was kind of teaching this pathetic literature seminar, Grove looked at the book and proposed that we make an anthology. And it's funny, I thought of the anthology, you know, 10 years ago, and then just, you know, how ideas come and go. And they were like, no, this is, you know, so I love that it's like one book will literally grow out of the next, which is really what happens. I think it is how books happen, but I've never been kind of commissioned by a publisher, and I sort of adore them for that.
Commissioned for the book after?
Well,
after
so they pathetic literature is coming up.
It's coming up.
Yeah,
okay, great.
Yeah.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Eileen Miles about her latest book, Afterglow, A Dog Memoir. I want to ask you a couple questions that come from sort of a ghostly or skeletal source, because I was at your talk last time you were here in Portland, at Portland State, and I have notes, but I don't even know it entirely, like, they're not super fleshed out. But I wanted to ask one just based on the jumping off point from the notes. So in the talk, you were confronting the question of being an artist in America today, among other things, amidst imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
And what you called the slave economy. And within that context, this idea that we have this deep insecurity that great art is being made elsewhere than America. And that this sort of insecurity that we have points to a certain type of American emptiness.
Uh-huh.
And then you compared American emptiness to the difference between that and the emptiness we think of in Buddhism.
I mean, I think that we've got American emptiness in the White House right now, you know, in a way. I think that's sort of like this Buddhism, which is like kind of not clinging to things, not clinging to ideas, and kind of even allowing the emptiness that is, you know, the self. And then perhaps you have, quote, enlightenment, which is meaning to kind of embrace breath and radiance and see everything for this fleeting phenomena, which is beautiful and ugly, and everything is in transit. But I think that there's also, like, what do we talk about the, you know, like the apocalyptic conditions of our planet, say, you know, like that, you know, like the understanding of, like, global warming, the understanding of, like, just raiding the earth and, you know, like, you know, kind of knocking down all the rainforests and not believing that any of the things that we're being told by scientists, by native people, by the people who have really honored, you know, how limited and how incredibly, you know, self-revitalizing the planet and nature is. It's sort of like all that's sort of ignored. I mean, like, I'm saying what we all know, you know, and it's like, but I think everybody knows that we're there. I see, this is my belief now. I think everybody knows we are there at you know, like ground zero in terms of resources. And the question is, do we just try and slow it down and come to an agreement that we're at this place, and if we can derail it, if we can slow it down, if we can do something different, that's an amazing way for the planet to kind of know each other? Or do we just have a party? You know what I mean? Like, just we just get a big keg,
yeah,
and drive as fast as we can and just close our eyes really tight and just, you know, dig our teeth into a big steak and say, woohoo, you know, like, because that might feel good too at the end of the world. And yeah. I think we're kind of, that's what's in the White House right now. And it's like drill, drill, drill. And I mean, so I think it's like in Buddhism, they call this kind of creature a hungry ghost, mm-hmm. where you just want to eat everything and you want to devour everything and you just want to, you know, like, just have as much as possible because you don't want to think or feel, mm. you know. So I think the one that kind of materialist, you know, kind of emptiness is in power right now, and that's what we're watching, a culture that doesn't care.
Maybe this is a good time to ask you the question of whether you would consider running for president again. You've noted that women have been running for president even before women had the right to vote. And it feels like you're at the height of your visibility right now, and also that we're clearly in an age where there's a sense of anything goes. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that Trump is president, that a socialist, someone who calls himself a socialist, non-Christian, possibly atheist, almost got the nomination for the Democrats. Mm-hmm. So it's maybe it is as much a time as ever for a queer woman, mm-hmm. president. Would you consider running against Trump?
I mean, I am so tempted, as you describe it.
Yeah.
You know, but I think, you know, and it's funny. It was like, even during the election, parts of me just felt like, God, I can almost taste it, you know, because it's such an interesting time. And I feel more experienced, you know. But no, I mean, I think, you know, like, I think once you've run, this question always comes up, you know. But I think I'm really doing well as what I am and what I'm doing now, which is to be sort of an indeterminate writer speaking animal person. And I would love a candidate or candidates. I mean, I can't help thinking that the answer is not a candidate, but tons of candidates. And for us to, but really an agreement, which we've never had, which is to say that, I mean, what we really messed up on this time is that when it became clear that it was, whether you like it or not, it was going to be Hillary, everybody drop all your sticks and run to the polls and vote for her, because this other thing could happen and it will be worse for all of us.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's the purpose of, you know, like, having a lot of parties in America was to have a big conversation and then to merge, you know, and make something happen, you know.
Yeah. It was great having you on the show today, Eileen.
Thank you. You've asked such smart questions.
We're talking today to Eileen Miles about her latest book, Afterglow, a Dog Memoir. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
Mm-hmm. Listen to The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of each month at 11:30 a.m. The Film Show features news and interviews about the local and independent film scene. That's The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of the month at 11:30 a.m., only on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Food for the Soul, a benefit for Potluck in the Park on Saturday, October 28th at the Tiffany Center in Portland. Food for the Soul is an evening of food, music, and fun benefiting Potluck in the Park. The night includes performances from Tom Grant, his band, and vocalists from around the PNW. Again, that's Food for the Soul, a benefit for Potluck in the Park on Saturday, October 28th at the Tiffany Center, 1410 Southwest Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Muertos PDX 9th annual Dia de los Muertos celebration on Sunday, November 2nd at noon at Adios Cinema in Portland. Muertos PDX will be hosting its annual Dia de los Muertos celebration with musical performances, a children's story time, calavera decorating stations, mariachi, Katrina's traditional Mexican cuisine, and much more. A portion of this year's proceeds will benefit Oregon por Mexico for earthquake relief in Mexico. Again, that's Muertos PDX 9th annual Dia de los Muertos celebration on Sunday, November 2nd at noon at Adios Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hey, welcome to The Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Concer, and it seems that we are rolling right back into festival season. And with that in mind, we have invited just about everybody into the studio today. Ben Pop is here.